Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Today's Times has a story on the first business page about Facebook's plans to spread internet connectivity to countries in the developing world without broadband capabilities. And on A1, there's a story about advances in face recognition surveillance. That push-pull of crossing borders on the one hand and clamping down on the other is the subject of the new book, The Internet Police, How Crime Went Online and the Cops Followed. Its author, Nate Anderson, is a deputy editor at Ars Technica, and he joins me now. Nate, welcome to WNYC.
Thanks for having me on.
Your book opens with the story of John Perry Barlow's 1996 Manifesto of Internet Freedom, and the idea was that the Internet could be beyond state jurisdiction somehow. Want to start there?
Yeah, I mean, we had this fascinating idea 10, 12, 15 years ago that the Internet was going to do something amazing for freedom. It was going to make total anonymous communication possible. It was going to challenge national laws because you could move your service to any country in the world where what you wanted to do was legal, and then you could reach people in any country in the world, maybe in places where what you wanted to do was illegal. And that was a premise behind a lot of what was happening 10 or 15 years ago, and it really scared people who worried this was going to lead to an incredible crime wave. There was going to be no way to stop it.
It took law enforcement a while to catch on and catch up.
That's right. I mean, it took them quite a while to learn the techniques. I mean, at the time, the people involved at local policing, the FBI, most of them had not come out of this world, you know, growing up using personal computers, using the Internet. It took a while to develop that capability to figure out how to make these investigations work. And I think what I trace in my book is just how, you know, remarkably successful the police have gotten at finding and busting people online.
You give a list of some of the things that maybe John Perry Barlow wasn't envisioning when he wrote his libertarian manifesto at Davos in the mid-90s. I'm going to read now from page 9 of your book, where you list some of the things that, unfortunately, many of our listeners will be all too familiar with as plaguing them on the Internet. Quote, penile enlargement emails, offers from Nigerian princes, phishing attempts from your bank, million-strong computer botnets, cyber warfare, stolen credit cards traded openly in hacker forums, online sextortion using stolen nude photos, corporate espionage, the underground online market for child sex abuse imagery, anonymous defamation in online forums. All these would be addressed how exactly without government. So why do you end with that question after that list of horribles from our online lives?
Because one of the things that the early pioneers of the Internet, many of them thought, was that we could create this new space. It would be its own world, really, that would not be subject to traditional laws, and you would have to come up with a new sort of laws and governance for this thing called the Internet that would be separate from our national laws. And it turns out no government on earth was basically willing to let that happen. And they found incredible ways of exerting control over it. You know, I think the one thing I'd add to that list that is really in people's consciousness this summer has been the rise of surveillance that we see. You know, it's not just going online and publishing things easily or buying books or reading blogs. It is your entire life online for governments to view. These are things that weren't really, either weren't envisioned at the time or were envisioned but were thought to be not that big of a problem, and we can deal with them on our own without the government.
Were there attempts at self-policing?
There were in many of these early online communities, but, you know, there just weren't effective ways to control some of these issues, especially true criminals. I mean, a lot of this came out of the time before the Internet was commercialized, and it really was a different place. It was mostly academics, researchers, engineers. And you just didn't have the same sorts of ills that you have today. And so I think it was very difficult to envision just what the Internet would look like 20 years down the road when it was used by billions of people.
Where are we now in terms of the most sophisticated tools used by criminals? You write about this thing called ratting, but not many people know what that means. So maybe tell us about that and any other state of the art being used by criminals online.
Yeah. Well, that one's a great example because it shows how no tool is really limited either to one side or the other in this fight. So a RAT is just an acronym for a remote administration tool. It's a bit of software that you try to slip onto someone's computer. Once it's there, it basically gives you total remote control. You can turn on their webcam and see what they're doing. You can listen to the audio through the microphone in their computer and have it fed back to you in real time. You can browse files on their computer. You can see what websites they're visiting. It's an incredible tool, and it's used by hackers all over the world to spy on people. We found last week that the new Miss Teen USA said it had happened to her. But it's also used by the FBI. You know, they try to keep this fairly hidden to disguise their techniques, but a search warrant came out a few weeks ago from a judge in Texas who denied their use of this kind of software because he ruled that there was no real way that they could know who they were looking at through the webcam, and they could potentially be invading the privacy of many people who were not the suspect. So these kinds of tools are used by everybody in this debate. It's just a question of whether, you know, they're under control and used for purposes that we want, or whether they're out of control and used for spying, voyeurism, and sextortion.
The Miss Teen USA story is really troubling. She announced that basically she had been spied on via her own webcam because somebody from a remote location was able to get control of her computer's webcam.
That's right.
And then I guess they were going to use the images of her to blackmail her?
Yeah, so they she didn't give all the details because the case is currently being investigated by the FBI, but this is unfortunately a somewhat common thing now. It's the FBI refers to it as sextortion. You usually get some kind of compromising photos of people, then you take those photos back to them and say, hey, I'm going to release these to the world. Your friends, your family are all going to see them. They're going to be on the internet unless you either give me money or, more commonly, provide more sexually explicit imagery and video to me. So we're really seeing a rise in that over the last 2 or 3 years.
And she says now she's going to use her year as Miss Teen USA to educate other teens about this danger. So maybe you can educate the rest of us a little bit. Is there any way to know if your computer has become a slave, that's the terminology, to someone controlling it remotely?
Yeah, you know, one of the best ways is looking at most modern computers have a tiny little light next to the webcam. And in most cases now, it is built directly into part of the hardware. The webcam cannot come on without that light going on. So if you see the light on your computer's webcam lighting up and you're not doing something, yes, it's time to get very suspicious. That, in fact, was how a school district actually was caught using this software in Pennsylvania a year or two ago. And that was how it was noticed. Students and teachers began to see this light coming on when they weren't doing anything. And they got so freaked out by it, many of them began taping over their camera lenses. And it eventually came out that the district had been watching them.
The district was spying on the students and the teachers for what?
It was the goal of the software was theft prevention. If the computer was stolen, you know, this is a powerful tool for figuring out who has it and potentially getting it back. But the district turned out to be snapping pictures of people who were sitting in front of their computer, even when they were off the school grounds, when they were at home. And it became a major scandal, and the district had to settle it for quite a bit of money.
Before you go, your book focuses on personal crimes, not so much on political action and anti-terrorism or the same tools as weapons of war. But up next, we'll be talking about the 35-year sentence just given this morning to Bradley Manning for providing classified documents to WikiLeaks. Do you see connections between the leakers like Manning or Edward Snowden or the recipients like WikiLeaks and the criminal enterprises that you cover in the book?
Well, I think the biggest connection that I would make that interests me is the WikiLeaks angle, because it really proves that what people both hoped for and feared 10 or 15 years ago was actually not an unrealistic thing to think, and that is you know, we can put the servers that host this material anywhere in the world. We can find a friendly place to put them, and then they can be accessed by anyone. And there's not much governments can do to stop it unless they're willing to take these really draconian measures. And that's exactly what has happened to WikiLeaks, which is still accessible, you know, despite the anger of the U.S. government, despite all these leaks that Manning has provided to them. You can still look at those files today. And so the people who thought that that was going to change our world were certainly correct about it.
Nate Anderson, deputy editor at Ars Technica and now the author of The Internet Police, How Crime Went Online and the Cops Followed. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And coming up next, we have the First Amendment lawyer Floyd Abrams, and we have Fred Kaplan, who writes the War Stories column for Slate, to analyze the sentencing of Bradley Manning this morning, 35 years for giving thousands of documents to WikiLeaks. And we'll take your reactions on the phones, 212-433-WNYC.